Well, if you would please turn in your Bibles to Deuteronomy. We're in the second chapter already. Have a lot of stuff that goes on Sunday evenings, and so that kind of makes the process a little bit spotted, I guess you might say. Deuteronomy chapter 2 this evening. I'd like to look at the first half of the chapter with you. That'd be verse 1 through 23. Deuteronomy chapter 2. Father, help us now as we open your word again. What a privilege it is to study your word. We just appreciate so much the opportunity to study it, to read it, to learn it, to know it, to know you by knowing your word. Show us yourself. You're a great God, and we are just so thankful to be your people. Show us how much you care for us. Show us how precisely you direct us. Encourage us here this evening, we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Well, the title for this sermon, He Knows You're Going Through This Great Wilderness, actually comes out of verse 7 of our text. If you look down at verse 7, for the Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hands. He knows you're going forth through this great wilderness. And at the initial reading of that, you might come away with the impression there's a misspelling of this pronoun. Here. You see Y-O-U-R? Because you would almost think that that should be the contraction, Y-O-U apostrophe R-E, you are, okay? God knows you are going through this great wilderness. And that's true, God does know you are going through this great wilderness, but that's not what the text says. The text is correct as it appears in the English translation. God knows you're going through the wilderness, and He knows my going through the wilderness. And that's the encouragement of the whole text, that God knows these things. Because if God knows the path that we're traveling, we can be really, really assured that He is working His plan. He's doing exactly what He wants to do in the process. So it really does seem like people who are walking a pathway that is already determined by God, we ought to be able to rest pretty contentedly in what's happening in our lives. I mean, in this confidence, we can just remember God has control of all things. Now, either He does or He doesn't. And if He knows the path that we're traveling, we ought to have that kind of confidence. But part of the problem that we deal with is a natural propensity for us just to want to make our own choices, to determine the path that we want to walk, to try to arrange circumstances according to our liking, according to our pleasure. Well, you know, that's not always possible for us to do that. In fact, there are a couple of really good reasons why we can't always arrange things the way we want to arrange things or walk the path that we want to walk. For one, we really don't know for sure which path is best to make us like Christ. And that's what God's doing in our lives. He is making us like Christ. And we don't have the wisdom to know which path we should take in order to achieve that goal. And so, better for us not. The second thing we're dealing with is the issue of sin. We are living in a world that is very, very sinful, which I think is a pretty fair description of this word wilderness. Okay, that we live in a wilderness in that sense. And so as a result of that, we can't always control circumstances. Sometimes, most of the time, those circumstances are beyond us. Because sometimes we're just dealing with a wilderness which is actually the result of our own sins. And the consequences come to bear. Because of that, we feel like we're in this kind of a wilderness thing. We're walking through it. God knows that. But sometimes we're walking in a wilderness that is actually the impact of someone else's sin. In fact, if you look at the broader picture, that's what life is like. I mean, everything that's going on in this world, so much of it is just a result of sinful actions and sinful attitudes by other people. But the encouragement of this text is, in all of that, not to worry. Okay? I say that. Did I ever tell you where that came from? That's not a common phrase. But there's this fellow, you hear about him a lot from frontline missions. When John Hutchison goes over to Ukraine, the guy who's the representative in Ukraine is Pavlo, and he's native Ukrainian. And we were on a trip over there several years ago, and every time we'd have a question or something, say, "Well, I don't know, is this the best thing to do, Pavlo?" He would always say, "Not to worry." Okay, so I thought that's a good way to look at God. Whatever's happening, not to worry. God has everything in control. He's got a plan. And if He has a plan, He's working the plan. And that's just sensible for us to put those two things together. And so God demonstrated this principle so vividly for His people all that time that they were walking through the wilderness. Now, the sad part is that they had to walk through the wilderness. It would have been great if, you know, they could have skipped right into the promised land, but they didn't. And even while they were wandering around in that desolate wilderness for 38 years, God was doing something. One, He was blessing their children. And now it's time for the second generation, those children, to move on, take the promised land that God had promised to give them. And we find Moses in this text giving them last-minute instruction before he passes off the scene and puts everything in the responsibility of Joshua. And so this last-minute instruction, and he says to them, there were many blessings in the wilderness. And he's rehearsing some of these blessings that God gave to those people because God had a plan. And because God had a plan, there was going to be some blessings taking place. The first four verses remind us of that plan. It's very specific. It's very clear. Because according to God's plan, and this was not an accident, it was according to God's plan that God's people were wandering around for many days out there in the wilderness. Look at verse 1. Moses is rehearsing this history to the second generation of people before they go into the land. And he tells how it was back in those days. Then we turned and journeyed into the wilderness, into the direction of the Red Sea. Now, obviously, you know, if you know the story of the Exodus, you know that's exactly what happened. Chapter 12, you have the Exodus, and then they go up and go to the Red Sea. And the Lord told me for many days we've traveled around Mount Seir. Okay, let's just kind of review this thing, all right? Now this is kind of what happened. Okay, it looks kind of like this. This is the land of Goshen, and this is where the Israelites were, and this is where they grew into a nation. The city of Ramses was a storehouse city, and that's probably where they left in the Exodus. When they left on the Exodus, they went south to Succoth. That's the first place that they went. But then God didn't leave them there. For a strange reason, He had to send them north. Why? Well, Beth Saffron is up there, and also the city of Migdol is somewhere around there. And that's kind of the Delta region, and there's a lot of bodies of water up there. And where they were headed was actually a place that would be known as, in your English translation, it's generally Red Sea. You ever hear the argument that they actually crossed the Reed Sea and it wasn't all that deep and la-da-da-da-da? You know how the liberals argue. Well, probably the Hebrew word is better translated, the Reed Sea. But being a Reed Sea, there was some kind of a large body of water up here, maybe even a lake. And it was large enough so that we read in Exodus chapter 14 that there was a wall of water on their left and there was a wall of water on their right, and they crossed through on dry land, so it was a pretty big body of water, whatever it was. And it also was big enough to drown the Egyptians. Now, having the Egyptians drown in 2 feet of water in a reed sea is no miracle. I mean, that was a miracle. This was a body of water large enough when it swept back over the Egyptian army, it drowned them. And so that's why God took them north, up there to around Beth Saffron and Migdol in this area in the Delta. Then, after that miracle crossing of the Red Sea, they traveled all the way down to the southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Probably Mount Sinai was right in that area there. At Mount Sinai, Exodus chapter 19 through chapter 40, at the end of the book, you have all this taking place there where God gave them the law, where God gave them the instruction for building the tabernacle, and God gave them the instruction for all the sacrificial service that they were supposed to be doing. Also, the golden calf incident happened there. And so they were there for many days. In fact, we read it was many days. Probably took them 3 months to travel from the Red Sea all the way down to Mount Sinai, southern part of the Sinai Peninsula. Then they hung around that mountain for about 2 years. When you read in the text, it was many days that they were in that area. They were probably there for about 2 years. Then they went north. Moses is talking about that in Deuteronomy chapter 1. Okay, they traveled north all the way up here to Kadesh Barnea. Okay, Kadesh Barnea is where they were on the verge of going into the Promised Land. Before they went into the Promised Land, what did they do? They said it'd be a good idea for us put some spies together, one person from each tribe, send them in, let them see what the land is like. They did. What was the response? They came back and said, the cities are walled up to the heavens. They got giants. The relatives of Anakim are there. We can't do this. They rebelled against God, said they would not do it. Then they turn around and say, well, I tell you what, we are going to do it, but now we're going to do it on our terms. And God judged them. And you read Deuteronomy chapter 1, as Moses rehearsed the account, they were beaten down by the Ammonites. And so the story picks up now where Moses is telling in chapter 2 how they wandered around in this area. This would be called the area around Mount Seir, or the wilderness of Seir. That's where they spent 38 years wandering. Remember, it took them about 3 months to go down here. They spent 2 years here. Now they're up here for 38 years. It's been 40 years. They come to wander around, and now they're back up in this area. And that's where Moses picks up the story after many days, last part of verse 1, and those many days happened to be about 38 years. And after all those years of wandering, God directed His people, and He says, now it's time for you to move on. Time to go a new way, new path, new direction. This is according to the Lord's leading. Verse 2, the Lord said to me, you've been traveling around this mountain country long enough. Turn northward and command the people. You're about to pass through the territory of your brothers, the people of Esau who live in Seir. They will be afraid of you, so be very careful. So in God's timing, according to God's plan, by the way, always remember, God works His plan according to His timing. And according to that timing, God says it's time to move. Why? Well, the first generation that rebelled against God, God promised they weren't going to get into the promised land, they would all die in the wilderness, and now they're all dead, for the most part. God instructed His people, now it's time to move northward toward the promised land. And so they were going to move up into an area where Esau's relatives lived. Okay, Esau was the brother of Jacob, you remember. Okay, so Esau's relatives lived there, and Moses warned the people, now when you march through that area, be very, very careful, because you're going to cause fear. Why? You know, the Jewish people, Israelites themselves, were not a fearful group of people, a fearsome group of people. But there was a lot of them. You'll remember from the original Exodus how many people left the land of Egypt. Well, the census gives us 600,000 grown men. Okay, 600,000 grown men, you're going to say that's probably about equivalent to 600,000 families. We don't know how large those families were, but if they were homeschoolers, they were pretty big. So, assuming there were just, you know, a few, it's somewhere between 2 and 6 million people. You know, if we went on the low end, that's a lot of folks. But on the high end, man, that's the population of South Carolina. Now, the whole population of South Carolina comes marching into your neighborhood. Yeah, that's going to cause a little bit of fear, and it made a lot of sense. And so Moses says, now your brothers are going to be, your relatives are going to be kind of concerned about this. And you know, I'm asking myself this question, how in the name of common sense does that many people survive for 40 years wandering around in that section on the Sinai Peninsula out there in the wilderness? Well, they could survive because God provided for them, and that's the only way they could survive. It might have been hard for us to kind of accept what God was doing with those very people, because Moses reminded them, you know, God actually blessed your forefathers. Verse 7, look down there. The Lord your God has blessed you in all the work of your hands. So somehow these millions of people wander around for 40 years in the wilderness out there, and not only did they survive, but according to this, they prospered. And not only the second generation, the children prospered, those people to whom Moses is talking at this time, but their parents did. And I find that remarkable because they were bad people. Now, we would just say that, wouldn't we? I mean, these were rebels. These were people who were always complaining. These were people who didn't do what God wanted them to do. They didn't do the right thing at Mount Sinai. I mean, they complained about water. They complained about bread. They complained about everything. And then they tried to take the promised land on their own terms. And God blessed them. He prospered them. More than that. Look at verse 7, the last part of the verse. These 40 years, the Lord your God has been with you. Why would He even condescend to hang out with those people? but they lacked nothing. God gave them water. God gave them miracle bread. God gave them quail. Deuteronomy chapter 8, Moses is still going, by the time we get there, I don't know, that's going to be Christmas or something by the time we get to Deuteronomy 8, but Moses is still telling this history of these people's parents. Verse 2, you shall remember the whole way the Lord your God led you through these 40 years in the wilderness, that He might humble you, testing you to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep His commandments or not. And He humbled you, and He let you hunger and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know, that He might make you to know that man does not live by bread alone, but man lives by every word that comes from the mouth of the Lord. Your clothing did not wear out, and your feet did not swell these 40 years. God just did an amazing thing in the way that He was caring for these people in order to teach them this incredible lesson. What's important is your relationship with Me and how you trust Me. Well, so God, in spite of their continual complaining, in spite of their sin, He just kept working with them. He just kept nurturing them. He just kept helping them learn how to become obedient. Folks, there's a very good principle here. As you watch these people, remember that God's plan for maturing us and making us understand Him and obey Him can be painful. It can be frustrating. It can be difficult, just like the wilderness. But God said, that's why I was doing this. Why? Well, because God knows. God knows. Verse 7. He knows you're going through this great wilderness. No surprise to God. He knew exactly what the first generation was going through. He knew what the second generation was going through. In fact, God knew, as the second generation is standing there, listen to Moses tell these stories. This is all they knew. Really, for the most part, this whole generation of people were born and lived and grew up for 40 years in the wilderness. I mean, all they knew was a nomad life. All they knew, pretty much, was that wandering around. Maybe a few of them had been born in Egypt, but probably not. And God knew what they were doing. He had to know because God is the one who orchestrated this plan. It was His plan. And He's the one to put it into force. And so the trying circumstances that these people were going through was not just a result or a consequence of their sins. Yes, it was that. But that was no surprise to God. When they failed God at Mount Sinai and they worshiped the golden calf, that did not surprise God. He knew that was going to happen. When they come to Kadesh Barnea and they will not go into the land and they rebel against God and they try to do it their own way and they get beat down, that was no surprise to God. He orchestrated all of that. It's all part of His plan. And sometimes that's hard for us to understand. And, you know, we just say, well, you know, this was man taking control, and then this is God responding, and this is... No, it's not. It's never like that. We are not more powerful than God. God knows. He knows you're going through this wilderness. Now, because God knows that, I want you to see what He does here. This is pretty amazing to me. It may not be amazing at all to you, but this is pretty amazing to me. The rest of this part of the text, through verse 23, God just gives illustration after illustration after illustration of how He knows and what He does. Isn't it great for God to give us pictures like that? You see, up to this point, Moses has been telling the story to these people that covered the last 40 years. And for the most part, it's just a story about these people's parents, their rebellion, their deathward consequences. But we have to remember, you still have this second generation of people here. They spent their lives out in the wilderness, drawing on God's provision, drawing on God's blessings, prospering under God's care. And now the story is kind of getting up to the present. You know, most recently, God had led this nation, remember, through the land of their relatives, Esau. Okay, so they've been led through that part of the land. But now watch how Moses recounts what happens to these people in the last part of this chapter. We learn that God gave Mount Seir to Esau. Why did He do that? Well, He wanted to. Okay, that was God's plan. God's provision was according to His sovereign choice. Verse 5. Do not contend with them, for I will not give you any of their land. No, not so much as for the sole of your foot to tread on, because I have given Mount Seir to Esau. It's his possession. I've given it to him. Now, again, that area of Mount Seir, you'll remember, was kind of where the area where Israel wanders around for 38 years. God says, you can't have it. That's not the promised land. I didn't give that to you. I gave it to Esau's lineage. So I'm not going to give any of it to you. Why did he give it to Esau? It wasn't because Esau earned it. God decided to give it to him. So I wonder, you know, this story, did this fact, this statement from Moses, did it register with the people of Israel? See that land right there, that chunk of land? That's not yours. I gave that to Esau. How'd you do that, God? Well, look at verse 12. The Horites also lived in Seir formerly, but the people of Esau dispossessed them and destroyed them from before them and settled in their place, as Israel did to their possession, which the Lord gave them. It's like, oh, this starts to sound kind of familiar. This is God's plan for His people. Mount Seir was not a desolate region that was occupied only by conies and badgers. There were people who lived there. And when the people were living there already, God said, now, Esau, that's your land. Go ahead and take it. And it really did look for all the world like Esau just kind of marched in there and discomfited the people and ran them out. They dispossessed them, destroyed them, took the land for themselves. But it was God who gave that to Esau and gave that land over to them and gave the people over to them, gave the possessions over them. Did that register with the people of Israel? Huh. If God can do that for Esau, I wonder if He could do that for us. See, that's why God gave them this example. God did it. Even though it really kind of looked like Esau did it. Look at verse 22. He did this for the people of Esau who lived in Seir when he destroyed the Horites before them. And they dispossessed them and settled in their place this day. Okay, God said, this is your land. You go ahead and take it. But God's the one who actually delivered it. So because of that, Israel, according to God's plan, just needed to respect God's choice. This is what God wanted to do. He gave it to Esau. You respect it. You walk through that area. You pay for the water you drink. You pay for the food you eat. Any of the crops you take. Verse 6. You shall purchase food from them for money that you may eat. You shall also buy water from them for money that you may drink. And God's people obeyed and did what God told them to do. Verse 8. So we went on our way from our brothers, the people of Esau, who live in Seir, away from Arabah, rode from Elath to Ezion-Geber, and we turned and went in the direction of the wilderness of Moab. So it's time for them to move north a little bit. So from Esau's area, they go up to Moab, which is directly east of the Dead Sea. Moab. Hey, wait a minute. Didn't he come from kind of a questionable family? Yeah, his family was an absolute mess, to be honest. And yet God gave Ar to Moab's people. The story is given to us in Genesis chapter 19, verse 37. When I start reading the story, you'll be very familiar with it. You say, oh yeah, I remember that. It's a terrible story, awful story. Genesis chapter 19, verse 30, Lot went up out of Zoar. He lived in the hills with his two daughters, for he's afraid to live in Zoar. So he lived in a cave with his two daughters. And the firstborn said to the younger, our father's old, there's not a man on earth. That's one of Satan's lies. Guys, listen, Satan just lies all the time. Always remember that. Satan lies. Okay, I have this rule, whenever I'm watching television, I just say over and over, that's a lie, that's a lie. And then I wonder why I watch TV. That's why I only watch sports. So anyway, let's get back to the point here. Okay. Firstborn says, our father's old, there's no other man on earth to come into us after the manner of all the earth. In other words, we need to have kids. Verse 32, come, let us make our father drink wine. We'll lie with him that we may preserve offspring from our father. So they made their father drink wine that night. Firstborn went and lay with her father. He did not know when she lay down, when she rose up. Genesis chapter 19, verse 37, the firstborn bore a son, called his name. Anybody want to guess? Moab. He's the father of the Moabites to this day. Well, okay, that was not exactly a God-honoring situation. You know, we're not going to say, wow, you know, these people are so Christian-like. You know, they went to church every Sunday. They're really nice folks. God, you ought to bless them. God said, no, I'll bless whoever I want to bless. This was a very wicked, terrible, awful, sinful situation. There's no question about that. What makes it even worse is Lot had all kinds of opportunities to learn how to be a righteous person from his uncle Abraham, who he lived around and lived with for a long time, and none of it seemed to rub off. And he goes out and lives like a fool. Lives his life in the lust of the flesh, teaches his children how to live according to the lust of the flesh, and so you end up with his children doing the very same thing. But look at what God did for Lot's son. God blessed him. Verse 9. The Lord said to me, do not harass Moab or contend with them in the battle, for I will not give you any of their land for a possession, because I've given Ar to the people of Lot for a possession. The Imam formerly lived there, a people great and many, tall as the Anakim. Like the Anakim, they're also counted as Rephaim, but the Moabites call them Imam. I know those names don't mean anything to you, but let's just suffice it to say there are a lot of big people there, okay? They're kind of like giants in that land. And God said, I gave it to Moab. And Israel, you don't get any of that land. You march through. You don't stop. That land belongs to Moab. And the Moabites were not exactly godly people. There were no churches in Moab. Only shrines for idols. They served false gods. They lived wickedly. They were perennial enemies of God's people. Later on, we'll see. They replaced the true God with images of their own creation. God gives them this land. Why? See, we always kind of think like, God blesses people because they deserve to be blessed. God blesses people because He wants to. It's His choice. And I'm wondering if any of these illustrations so far of God's sovereign blessing according to His choice just happens to be registering with God's people. I mean, here, God is preparing to send His people into a very similar circumstance, taking over the land that He had promised to give to Abraham, running out some really powerful, well-situated groups of people. Could they take the land and possess it? Well, I answer that question with another question. Did God give it to them? Yes. Why? He wanted to. Oh, God did something else that He planned on doing. Moses rehearsed this to the people. He let all the rebels die according to His promise. You know, why would God do that sort of thing? Well, because the people did what He commanded. Wait. If the people were obeying God, isn't that a reason to bless them? Why did God let them die? I mean, look at verse 13. Now rise up, go over the brook Zered. So we rose up, went over the brook Zered. I mean, we did exactly what God asked us to do. God said after 38 years, move, we moved. God said, move north. We're moving north. We're going to do exactly what God asked us to do. And yeah, but remember, this is the second generation. Most of the first generation of rebels, they're dead. And maybe it will appear that the people kind of learned from God that when He says something, He means it. And when He makes a promise, He keeps His word. And when He promised that all those people would die in the wilderness, they were going to die in the wilderness. And so the first generation of God's people, they reaped what they sowed. Verse 14, at the time from our leaving Kadesh Barnea until we crossed over the brook Zered, it was 38 years, until the entire generation, that is the men of war, had perished from the camp, as the Lord had sworn to them. For indeed, the hand of the Lord was against them to destroy them from the camp until they had perished. 38 years. That was God's timing. Remember, in that period of 38 years, God provided for them. God cared for them. God gave them all the water, the food that they needed. God blessed them. God even prospered them. But God had still made His promise. Because of your rebellion against me, you will die without going into the promised land. Would God keep His word? From the golden calf incident on, God was keeping His word, keeping His word, keeping His word. And so the hand of the Lord was against them, just like God had sworn. Look at the timing in this thing. Verse 16. As soon as all the men of war had perished and were dead from among the people, the Lord said to me, "Today you are to cross the border of Moab at Ar." Did God do what He promised to do? Precisely. Would God do what He promised to do the children of Israel? Can't they learn? God says, "Well, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'll give you another illustration." Okay, here's another one. He gave land to the Ammonites. Ben-Ammi was the son of Lot, again, this by the younger daughter, Genesis chapter 19, verse 38. The younger also bore a son, called his name Ben-Ammi. He's the father of the Ammonites. Again, horrible, wicked, terrible rebellion against God's law. And again, the relatives of Ben-Ammi, the Ammonites, had absolutely no time whatsoever for God. They replaced God with idols. God blessed them. And even in Moses' day, years later, he protects this possession that he gave to the Ammonites. Because this was his choice. He gave this land to them. So now Israel moves north. You see, they're positioning themselves across over the Jordan River into the Promised Land. And they're in the land of the Ammonites. God says, "Now, that's not your land. I'm giving you some land north of there for the Reubenites and the half-tribe of the Manasseh, but not Ammon." Okay, verse 19, "When you approach the territory of the people of Ammon, do not harass them or contend with them, for I will not give you any of the land of the people of Ammon as a possession. I have given it to the sons of Lot for a possession." And notice how God did that. He gave this land to them by taking it away from a very powerful and strong people. Verse 20. "It is also counted as a land of Rephaim. Rephaim formerly lived there, but the Ammonites called them Zamzumim." I would have just called them giants, probably. "A people great, many, tall as the Anakim. But the Lord destroyed them before the Ammonites, and they dispossessed them, and they settled in their place." God gave that land to the Ammonites. He said, "I don't care if giants do live there. Go on in. Dispossess them. Throw them out. Take their homes. Take their farms. I've given you the land that belongs to you. And I'm going to protect it." Now, that wasn't always going to be the case in the future. In fact, with all these tribes, what we discover is once God put His people in the land of Israel, and you have King David rising up, and these tribes, these nations begin to attack God's people, God uses His obedient kings to destroy them. I mean, you have David constantly fighting with the Moabites, with the Ammonites. But for now, God was protecting them because He said, "I gave them that land. Now, Israel, you just march right through." All right, we kind of get the picture, right? I mean, this is starting to make sense. We're starting to see a pattern here. We're starting to say, when God gives His word, He keeps His word. Right? One more example. Okay? Look at verse 23. "As for the Avim, who lived in the villages as far as Gaza, the Kaphtorim, who came from..." This sounds like something C.S. Lewis would write in the Chronicles of Narnia, doesn't it? But these are real tribes and real people. "Who came from Kaphtor, destroyed them, and settled in their place." Now really, this one almost seems like it's out of place. Like, wait, whoa. Moses, why are you telling us about these people? Now, it doesn't make too much sense to you until you look at a map. And when you look at a map and see who these people are, they're clear over on the west coast of Palestine, that is. Notice in the text there, the Avim lived in the area of Gaza. Now that rings a bell for you, doesn't it? Gaza was one of the five cities of the Philistine Pentapolis. There's Gaza, Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gath. The Kaphtorim, who came from Kaphtor, were the Philistines. They were the Philistines. And they moved into, get this, Palestine, which is named after the Philistines. See, this whole battle is still going on in Israel right now. You know what the Palestinians are? They trace their roots back to the Philistines. These people came into this region in the 1200s B.C. And they had a plan. When they moved into the west coast along the Mediterranean Sea, their plan was to go right on down to Egypt. And they were going to wipe out Egypt. They were going to take over Egypt. They were a mighty people, and they thought this is what they were going to do, and that was their plan. You'll remember that these are the very same people, by the way, all the way back in the 1200s at the time of Abraham. They kept filling up the wells that Abraham and his son dug. Remember that? That was the Philistines. See, they were in that area. They were down around Beersheba, which is just on the northern side of the Sinai Peninsula there. And their plan was to go down and take over Egypt, but it didn't work very well. Ramses III, who was the Pharaoh of Egypt, defeated them. So they kind of settled down in the western part of Palestine there. Did God know about them? Well, actually, you ready for this? God gave them that land. God gave it to the Philistines. If any of these names or dates that I've been kind of throwing out here kind of register with you, there's a reason for that. They all figure significantly in the history of God's people. God led His people out of Egypt in about 1440 B.C. They began settling in the Promised Land some 40 years later, probably around 1405. Then for about 400 years, till the year 1050, time of Saul and David, end of Samuel's reign, there were these people called the Judges. Remember that study we just went through a few months ago? And during the period of the Judges, what people group more than any other people group harassed them over and over and over? Who was it? The Philistines. Now we're saying, okay, God, we trust You. We think You're right. We trust Your Word. You're going to do what You say. Why in the name of common sense did You put the Philistines there? Why did You give them that land? If You knew that they were going to be doing this to Your people, why did You do this? I mean, from the first Judges all the way to Solomon, really even David had to fight with them. And why? God says, well, I'll give You the answer. They were for the testing of Israel, to know whether Israel would obey the commandments of the Lord, which He commanded their fathers by the hand of Moses. God said, that's why I put them there. During the settling of the land and all the way to the monarchy, I want to know, are you going to obey Me? And every time you failed, and every time you dropped the ball, and every time you left Me and went to the gods of your neighbors, I sent the Philistines in. They got your attention. Then I let you beat them. We did really well for about 40 years, and then, sure enough, you fell again. You went back into that sin. I sent the Philistines in. That's why God put them there, to test them, to test His own people. Now, let's draw some conclusions from the lessons that we learned from these illustrations. One is this: God does whatever He chooses to do. We have to trust that. We have to believe that. That it is God's choice. I mean, we're not the one who determines the outcome or the circumstances. God does whatever He chooses to do. Number two, because of that, sometimes it's very difficult for us to understand why God chooses to do what He does. I mean, you surely have times like this in your life. Especially when we think of precedents. I mean, there is this principle in the Bible. It's very, very clear that God rewards the righteous and He punishes the unrighteous. I mean, that is all through the Bible. Yes, that is absolutely true. But sometimes He does things other than that. Sometimes God sends the rain on the unjust. Sometimes He allows wicked people to prosper. But if God is holy, why would He bless an unholy people? Like, just want to think of an example, maybe Russia or China or your coworker or a wayward family member. Why would God do that? See, we have everything all figured out. we're America. God bless America. You know, okay, we just know that God's going to bless America from sea to shining sea and amber waves of grain and, you know, all the rest. What would you think if it came to pass, as I read in an article this past week, that it's very, very likely, according to this person, and I don't know if this person knows his head from a hole in the ground, but he believes that sometime in the near future, we're literally going to be under attack from China. Now, why would God do that? I mean, come on. We're God's nation, and China, they're communists. Right? Well, actually, we're no more righteous than they are. And if God wanted to do that, what would you say? Would you trust God? Would you say God does everything well, God has a plan, God has a purpose, God knows what He's doing? Then you'd be like an obedient Israelite who trusted God. If you rise up and say, "No, wait a minute, God. Hey, God, where are you? Everything's out of control here. Something's not working according to your plan because, God, I know that your plan and my plan are the same." We kind of do that in life, don't we? And things kind of go awry in our life and we say, "Whoa, what's happening here? This wasn't supposed to happen. You know, Lord, I've been really, really faithful. I go to church all the time. I tithe. I pray. I read the Bible. I sing. This isn't supposed to happen, God." Well, it's God's choice. Another question, how could God ever use a person who sinned in the past to accomplish His will? You know, like Lot's sons, Moab, and Ammon. How could God possibly bless them? Esau? I mean, God blessed Jacob. Yeah, He also blessed Esau. And then when we start thinking that maybe it's impossible for God to use somebody in the past who has sinned and been forgiven, and maybe we ought to think about this guy named Saul of Tarsus. If God used him, or even Joseph. You know, Joseph was not a squeaky clean choir boy. All right, you just have to understand, he was arrogant. He was an arrogant, conceited, spoiled little brat to the age 40. No. When he was a teenager, he got that taken out of him in a prison in Egypt. God used him. God used David. God used Peter. Well, what about those two sons of thunder, James and John? You know, title Sons of Thunder is not exactly a spiritual title. Says something about their attitudes. Man, how God used them. Because that was His choice. And according to Moses' rehearsal of events, God blessed and prospered His people, even though they rebelled. That's what God does. And even though He prospered them, and even though He blessed them, while He was prospering them and blessing them and showing His care and showing His concern and leading them like a shepherd through the wilderness, He was killing them off. Because He said that's what He'd do. And it's really hard for us to put those things together. We say, well, you know, if God's going to kill them off, why didn't He just do it all at once? Answer? What would their children do? Their children had to grow up. So God just slowly but surely kept His word, blessed the parents for the sake of the children. Sometimes it's just difficult for us to allow the consequences of past sin to exist alongside the blessings of current obedience. It's hard for us to put those two things together. You know, we feel like it should be one or the other, but not both at the same time. And while we're contemplating these difficult things, above all, we must remember that God is in control of all things at all times, and God does what He deems best. So whatever God is doing is best. It's right. It's good. It's the best thing. So we should rejoice. I mean, we should think back, kind of like Moses was doing with the people here, and think back to how God has manipulated whole nations, whole people groups, for His glory. I mean, at times He has raised up whole nations for His glory. Cyrus, the Persians, What a story that is. He doesn't ask us to always understand, and He doesn't always ask us to explain what He's doing. He asks us to trust Him. In all of these things, God says, I know you're going. Do you believe that? Do you trust that? You say, God, I can't always explain this going of mine. I can't always explain why I'm going down this path, but I'm trusting you to lead me and guide me and give me direction. Can you say that tonight with all your heart? Lord, I trust you. You're going to do the best thing. You're going to do the right thing. If I will just trust God, it sure will make things a whole lot easier. Doesn't that make sense? Got it? Any questions? Good. Let's just trust the Lord to do the things that He knows is best, even though it's a little bit hard to explain sometimes. Father, thank you so much for being a great God. Thank you for giving us these words. Thank you for driving them into our hearts and helping us to see what kind of a God you are and how you orchestrate things for your own glory. Lord, help us to praise you, even when we don't understand. We pray in Jesus' name. Amen.